We're going to talk about the Egyptian bondage, and you're probably looking and saying, what's the big deal? What's the difficulty here? Because it's not that it's all that difficult. But the reason why I'm going to go through this, and it is probably a little more of a technical type of sermon, but as Christians, we need to be prepared to make a defense. We have people who don't follow God's word, and they figure out that if they can cast doubts in one area, then basically the implication is they can ignore the Bible in all areas. In Jude verse 3 is where we're going to start with. Jude verse 3. It says, beloved, while I was making every effort to write to you about our common salvation, I felt the necessity to write to you appealing that you contend earnestly for the faith, which was once for all handed down to the saints. We are to be able to contend for the faith. That means sometimes that people are going to try to pick flaws, try to find difficulties, try to make arguments that we need to defend against. In 1 Peter chapter 3, and in verse 15, it says, but sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. Now, one way that people pick on the Bible is to point out what appears to be a contradiction. And then they jump on it, they argue about it, and then say, well, hey, the Bible contradicts itself, therefore the Bible cannot be inspired. And actually, they're in that way true. If there are internal contradictions that are existing in the Bible, then it is a casting of saying that this is not from God, because God should not be able to, would not contradict himself. Now, in defending a claim against a claim of contradiction, you don't necessarily have to prove beyond all doubt what the truth is. That's what a lot of people make the mistake of. They look at it and say, well, I have to absolutely prove it is this way. Sometimes that's not always possible because we're not back there. We can't give the exact proof. All that's really necessary is to show that there is a way that two what appears to be differing statements can simultaneously exist and be true. That's sufficient for a defense. It doesn't necessarily say which is true, but if you can show that these two statements can be simultaneously true, therefore it takes away the idea that there's a contradiction there. For example, just to give you an illustration of this having nothing to do with what we're going to start with, if you ask how many angels were at Jesus' tomb, if you look at Matthew chapter 28. Matthew 28. And starting with verse 2. Matthew 28. Starting with verse 2, it says, and behold, a severe earthquake had occurred, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled away the stone that sat upon it. And his appearance was like lightning, and his clothes was white as snow. How many angels were there? One. That's what Matthew says. In Mark 16, and in verse 5. Entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting at the right, wearing a white robe, and they were amazed. How many does Mark say? One. We go to Luke 24, and in verse 4, Luke 24, verse 4, says, and while they were perplexed about this, behold, two men suddenly stood near them in dazzling clothing. How many angels were there? Two. And in John 20, and in verse 12, John 20 and verse 12, and they saw two angels in white standing, or sitting, one at the head and one at the feet, where the body of Jesus had been lying. How many angels? Two again. Well, wait a minute, doesn't that sound like a contradiction? Matthew and Mark say one, Luke and John say two. Who's right? Well, if you go back and look again, one of the things you ought to ask yourself is, where were they and when were they there? For instance, Matthew's account says that there was an angel on the stone outside the tomb before the women arrived. Luke's account says there was one inside the tomb on the right-hand side. Luke's account, that was Mark's account, Luke's account says there was two inside. John's account says there's two inside, one by the head and one by the foot. Is there actually a contradiction here? The answer is no. Each account mentions details, but none of them mentions all the details at once. To mention one doesn't eliminate two. Not unless you say only one. And the word only doesn't appear. To mention one in one location doesn't mean an angel can't move later and be in a different location. Now, we may not know all the details. And here's why I'm saying, I can't tell you the absolute truth. There could have been three angels. One on the outside, two on the inside. That would still cover all the facts. It could have been two angels. One was on outside and moved inside. That still covers all the facts. Do I know exactly what happened? The answer is no. But do I have enough information here to say there's no contradiction? The answer is yes. The different accounts can be resolved, and we got at least one way, actually we got several ways, that we could resolve it, and still they all say the same thing. That's sufficient to say there's not a contradiction here, we just don't know all the detailed facts. So then, with that in mind, we are going to go to Genesis 15, and in verse 13. This is one of the places where God is making a prophecy about what's going to happen to the children of Israel. In Genesis 13, verse 15, Genesis 15, verse 13, God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in the land that's not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I'll also judge the nation which they will serve, and after that they will come out with many possessions." How long were the Israelites in bondage? 400 years is what God said would happen. In Exodus 12, and in verse 40, Exodus 12, and in verse 40, it says, "Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years. And at the end of 430 years, to the very day, all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." How long were they in Egypt? 430 years to the day. It's very specific here. We go to Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7, and in verse 6. "But God spoke to this effect, that his descendants would be aliens and foreigners in the land, and that they would be enslaved and mistreated for 400 years. We go back to 400 years. We go to Acts 13, and in verse 17, Acts 13, verse 17, "The God of this people, Israel, chose our fathers and made the people great during their stay in the land of Egypt. With an uplifted arm, he led them out from it for a period of about 40 years. He put them up with them in the wilderness. And then he destroyed seven nations in the land of Canaan. He distributed their land as an inheritance, all of which took about 450 years. So here, Paul says it was 450 years. And then we go to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3. And in verse 17, what I'm saying is this, the law which came 430 years later does not invalidate the covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. So Paul says that it was 430 years, but what we want to do is go back and look again. The 400 years in Genesis 15 says, doesn't give us a starting point. Again, we need to ask where and when. It doesn't tell us when, but it says 400 years with them coming out with many possessions. Exodus 12 says from the entering into Egypt, it was 430 years to the day that they left. Acts 7 verse 6 again gives no starting or ending point particularly, but says that they were enslaved 400 years. In Acts 13, it says their stay from the start of their stay in Egypt, then 450 years later was the conquest of Canaan, the conquering of Canaan. Galatians chapter 3 verse 17 says, from the covenant being ratified, it was 430 years to the giving of the law. Now, the reason why we're going back through all this is I want you to notice that the start and end points differ in each of these phrases. You look at it and say, oh, there's a contradiction. No, we're measuring different periods of time. Not everyone's measuring exactly the same period. Yeah, we can gloss over it. But the fact is we're measuring different periods. We can't just say, oh, it's a rounding error or rounding it up. These numbers are too varying to be just say, oh, we'll dismiss it by being rounded. But rather what we see is that there's a different start and end point. Different periods are being measured. Now, what you'll see also, and this is part of the problem that we come up with, is there are a lot of timelines that give the Egyptian bondage as being 215 years. I find that absolutely flabbergasting, especially when you get the passage in Exodus 12 that says very specifically they were there 430 years to the day. And yet you get a lot of timelines that show it as being 215. And the question is, how do you get that? Well, they take the one in Galatians and says, well, from the covenant being ratified to the giving of the law was 430 years. And so then they work it this way. Oops, I've left off my chart here, sorry. Here's all the different starting points and ending points. Just to show each one. We don't know exactly when, but they leave with many possessions. They enter Egypt, leave Egypt. Start of slavery, end of slavery. Staying in Egypt to the conquest of Canaan, covenant being ratified, the giving of the law. But in Galatians chapter 3, it says from the covenant being ratified to the giving of the law was 430 years. Now, the way you end up with 215, here we go, Paul said 430 years. Well, Abraham received that promise initially when he was 75 years old. Isaac was then born when Abraham was 100. So they take the 430 years, we take off the 25 years from the time when the promise was first given. Isaac was 60 years old when Jacob was born. And you can find that in Genesis 25, verse 26. You want to double check that one. So we take off 60 years more. And Jacob was 130 years old when he was in Egypt because he was presented before Pharaoh. And one of the questions Pharaoh asked was, well, how old are you? He was unusually old, even in that day and time. And in Genesis 47, Genesis 47 and verse 9. So Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. I've lived so far 130 years. They're just a little bit. Haven't lived all that long. Haven't come close to the ages of my ancestors. We would look at the other way around nowadays. But it was unusual. So they subtract 130. What do you get? 215. So they said, ah, then the time in Egypt had to be 215 years. Because that's, you know, you subtract all those different years out and we end up with 215. Well, there's a problem though. The prophecy that we saw in Genesis 15, God told Abraham, well, there's 400 years of bondage. That's quite clear. So what happened to the 400 years of bondage if they were only in Egypt for 215? And believe it or not, the way they argue it is they say, well, if you subtract from when they left Egypt 400 years, that actually puts you to when Isaac was 5 years old. Oh, that's when Ishmael was taunting Isaac. And that's what caused Ishmael to be kicked out of the household. Ishmael, the son of Hagar, and she's an Egyptian. Ishmael is then half Egyptian. So that must have been what God meant by afflicted for 400 years. Because of the word afflicted, bondage, or oppression, you can interchange all that. So that must be what they're meaning. It started with Ishmael and it continued on later. Jump several hundred years later. And that was their affliction. So that's how they get the 400 years. But go back to Genesis 15 just for a moment. And I want you to know something else that they ignore. God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. They will be in a land that is not theirs, enslaved 400 years. People jump over that fact, this is in a land not theirs. So if you get the, you know, yeah, we're really stretching things, you can say, well, the affliction started with Ishmael, taunting Isaac when he was 5 years old. But that's not even close to in slavery. But then somehow saying, well, wait a minute, they were supposed to be in a land that's not theirs. They're supposed to be in a foreign land. 400 years. So it still doesn't fit. It still doesn't work out. What we go back to, though, is noticing that Exodus 12, as we mentioned before, is very precise. Because of that precision, it says 430 years to the day. There's no wiggle room there, other than 24 hours. You got 24 hours worth of wiggle room in that statement. That's it. Because of that precision, we ought to use that as the baseline. Israel entered Egypt as free people, and it was only afterwards that they were oppressed. Take a look at Exodus chapter 1 and in verse 8. Exodus chapter 1 verse 8, then a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of war, they will also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart the land. So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. It was after they entered Egypt that the bondage actually started. Well, if you combine then what Genesis 15, verses 3 through 4, and Acts 7, verse 6, both of them said it was 400 years of slavery. Well, now we can put the two together. 430 years to the day in Egypt, the slavery started 30 years afterwards. It was 40 years before Joseph's death. Joseph hadn't died yet, but the new Pharaoh rose who did not know Joseph. And from what it's basically saying, it started. It wasn't instant, but it was a gradual thing that started 30 years after they were in Egypt. Okay, well, that now we've matched Exodus with Genesis 15 with Acts 7. All of them fit together. They make sense. How about Acts 13? Acts chapter 13, verse 17. Well, if we start out with 400 years of slavery, which is what we've already established before, they're at Mount Sinai for about a year to get the law. In fact, let's go to Numbers chapter 1. Numbers chapter 1. And in verse 1, then the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of the meeting on the first of the second month, in the second year after they come out from the land of Egypt, saying, take a census. This is 1 year plus 1 month, in the second year, first month. So in other words, 13 months after they left Egypt. So a year afterwards, we'll just round it to a year. Then we add the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness in Numbers 32 and verse 13. Numbers 32, verse 13, so the Lord's anger burned against Israel, and he made them wander in the wilderness 40 years until the entire generation of those who had done evil in the sight of the Lord was destroyed. Well, Acts 13 says it was 450 years. 400 years plus 1 year plus 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, at least 9 years to conquer Canaan. And that was the ending point to the conquest of Canaan when they had conquered it. They had not taken over the entire land in the sense that they subdued everybody in that land. They never really managed to do that until David and Solomon's reigns. But if we add those years up, how long was Joshua's conquest? It was about 9 years. And even if we're off by a year, 1 or 2 years, Paul said about 450 years. So even if we're off a year or two, we're still in the well within the margins of what he said it would be. So in other words, this one matches everything up too. This fits perfectly well with all the other verses. Which then leaves us with Galatians 3 and verse 17. And we're going to go back there because I want you to read this carefully. We mentioned this in the Dell class. But in case you weren't there, I want you to look at this real carefully as far as the starting point. When I was saying this, the law, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. The covenant came 430 years after it was ratified. Well, ratified means when it was confirmed. That's what ratification means. When it was confirmed. Now, we got a problem even if you just say, okay, when was the covenant given? Because the covenant was given to Abram at that time in Genesis 12 when he was 75. In Genesis 15, when Abram was 89, God gave him the promise again. And gave him some more terms about it. In fact, the most detailed one is in Genesis 15. And then in Genesis 17, when he was 99, God again talked about the promise and added more terms. That's where circumcision came in and some other factors came in. And then when Abraham offered Isaac, after that offering, after God says, I'm pleased that you did not withhold your only son, in Genesis 22, 16 and 18, he again mentions the promise. So which starting point are you going to say was the promise to Abraham? If you say it's the promise, we got over 75, because Isaac probably was 17, 18, probably in his late teens anyway, when the offering was given. It was just rounded to 20. We got 45 years difference here, just in when the promise was given to Abraham, because it was given multiple times, each time adding different terms. But like I said, the word says ratified when it was reaffirmed. When was the covenant ratified? Well, in Genesis 26 and verse 24, it was ratified with Isaac. In Genesis 28, verse 14, it was ratified with Jacob. And that was when Jacob was escaping and had slept all night on a rock, a poor pillow. In Genesis 35, when Jacob is coming back into Canaan, it's ratified again with him. In Genesis 35, 10 through 12, again with Jacob. And let's go to Genesis 46, because this is the third time it's ratified with Jacob. And this one is when Jacob's about to leave the land of Canaan to enter into Egypt. In Genesis chapter 46, and in verse 2, God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. And he said, I am the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I'll make you a great nation there. I'll bring you I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. That's one of the promises that was made to Abraham. I'll make you a great nation. It was just reaffirmed by God. It was ratified. I'm going to keep it through you. Don't worry about going to Egypt, because I'm going to keep it with you. Well, that was when Jacob was just about to go into Egypt. Exodus 12, verse 40 to 41 says 430 years later, to the very day, they left Egypt. And in Exodus 19, and verse 1, as they were leaving Egypt, 3 months after they left Egypt, Exodus 19, verse 1, then in the third month, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. And it's in the wilderness of Sinai that God gave them the law. So it's 3 months after. It's 3 months, we can round 3 months. Paul said 430 years from the giving of the law to when the covenant was ratified. It is 430 years. Just which ratification would Paul have in mind? Well, we know when the giving of the law was. You just back up 430 years, and there is a ratification there. That would be what Paul had in mind. Again, if everything fits. There's no magic with the numbers. Everything's consistent. In other words, all those passages, even though they look at first like, wait a minute, 400, 430, 400, 430, 450, you're saying there's no way they all fit. The answer is, yeah, they all fit very well. Even though they had different start and different ending points, they still fit. Now, there are some objections. I want to cover these as best I can. I was going to cover them quickly, but I got a page and a half here. It shouldn't be that bad. The question is, in Genesis 15 and verse 16, here's one of the objections. Even though all this fits really nice and smoothly together, that doesn't satisfy some. It says, then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. God said they would come back in the fourth generation. And that's caused some heartaches. Because how long is a generation? Right now we use a generation to be about 25 years, roughly. But the question is, how long is a generation? Well, you know, Abraham lived 175 years. That's in Genesis 25, verse 7. Isaac lived 180 years. That's in Genesis 35, verse 28. Jacob lived 147 years. That's in Genesis 47, verse 28. Joseph lived 110 years. He's the short life one of all these. Now, and that's 110 years anyway. That's Genesis 50, verse 26. How long is a generation? In that family, a generation isn't 25 years. If we just say, hey, you know, maybe God had in mind is 100 years. Well, that makes 400 years. That's roughly what God was talking about. And that would still fit. Another problem we have is in Moses' lineage. And I'm not going to take time to read all of these. But let's go to Exodus chapter 6 and verse 16. Because it has probably the most detail because it has dates in it. Exodus chapter 6 and in verse 16. And I'm going to have trouble because I've got all these names to read. These are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations: Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The length of Levi's life was 137 years. The son of Gershon, Shimni, according to their families, the sons of Kohath, Izhar, Hebron, and Israel. And the length of Kohath's life was 133 years. The son of Merari, Mahal, and Mushi, these are the families of the Levites according to their generations. Amram married his father's sister, Jochebed, and she bore him Aaron and Moses, and the length of Amram's life was 137 years. Now, one of the things also that I will take note of is some of the translations, either here or in one of the other ones, say that Jochebed was a daughter of Levi. Now, that could be a generalized saying, a descendant of Levi. But notice he did marry his aunt. Okay. So, Levi lives 137 years, and Kohath lives 133 years, Amram lives 137 years, and Moses is then born to Aram and Jochebed. We also know that Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt at the age of 80. We oftentimes forget about how old some people are. Moses was leading the children of Israel at 80. And it's Exodus chapter 7. And in verse 7, Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. One of the reasons why I pointed out is if you think later, he goes and climbs Mount Sinai. He doesn't do it once. He does it six times in the course of the time they were in there. He's climbing up and down Mount Sinai six times at the age of 80 plus. I hope I can climb mountains when I'm 80. Okay. Now, here's where the problem is. We also know that Kohath was born prior to Israel's entrance into Egypt. There's a list of who went in Genesis chapter 46, verse 11. There's a list of 70 people that went into Egypt. Kohath is one of the ones listed as going in. Okay, so we know Kohath already lived before they went in. Now, even if we assume that Kohath was born the year they entered Egypt, which is not likely, and that both Aram and Moses were born the years their fathers died, which is, again, not very likely, the maximum length of time in Egypt would be 350 years. In other words, we're missing about 80 years in that lineage. Somewhere there's another 80 years. And that becomes a difficulty. And the problem is also that same genealogy is listed, as I showed you before. There's several verses. It's in Numbers 3, verses 17 to 30. Numbers 26, 57 to 59. 1 Chronicles 6, 1 through 3. 1 Chronicles 23, 6 through 13. That lineage is repeated word for word, not word for word, but it's repeated with the same people multiple times. And we're missing 80 years. Now, one of the possibilities is the Hebrew concept of son is more general than ours. In Matthew chapter 1 and verse 1, just to illustrate this, talks about Jesus and his lineage. In Matthew 1, verse 1, it says, the record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. How can you be the son of David and the son of Abraham? Some people actually ask that question. How can you have two fathers? Especially two fathers that live so far apart. The answer is the Hebrew idea of son is a descendant, a male descendant, not necessarily a direct descendant like we use the word son. In fact, there's other verses. There were kings of Judah were sons of David. We'll just show another example. 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 3. 1 Kings 15, verse 3. He walked in all the sins of his fathers, which he had committed before him. His heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, like the heart of his father David. Okay. But we're not talking about David's son. If you jump down to verse, same chapter, verse 11, it says, Asa did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like his David, his father. Asa is like a great-grandson. Or great-great-grandson of David. But it still was considered a son. And David was his father. His ancestor in that sense. And there's another example in 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 50. And there are also, and I'm not going to take time to go through that, otherwise we'll be here past time to leave. There are cases of skipped generations in the Bible. I can show you several cases where one verse shows against another verse that there are generations that are being skipped. In other words, a lot of times when they did the generations, they would get the main highlights and not necessarily list up every single person in the generation. So while this doesn't prove there was any skipped generations in Moses' lineage, we can't rule it out either. Because we know that such do occur. But there's something else that we need to keep in mind. In Numbers chapter 3, in that first numbering of all the Israelites, it gives us how many in Kohath's family left Egypt. In Numbers chapter 3 and verse 27, Numbers chapter 3, verse 27, of Kohath was the family of the Amorites, and the family of the Israelites, and the family of the Hebronites, and the family of the Uzzites, and these were the families of the Kohaths. In the numbering of every male from a month old and upward, there were 8,600 performing the duties in the sanctuary. 8,600 males, 1 month and older. If another numbering that comes in Numbers chapter 4, we won't bother reading in verse 34 and 36, it tells us there were 2,750 men between the ages of 30 and 50 in that same family. When we go back to Exodus, we know Kohath had 4 sons, 12 grandsons, and at least 6 great-grandsons, which included then Aaron and Moses' children, numbering it that way. And since we know the generations of Moses and Aaron, we know how many kids they had. That means that Kohath's other 10 grandsons would have to have an average of 860 male descendants in that 80-some year time frame. That Aaron, while Moses was gone and came back, we need about 860 males descending from the same generation that Moses and Aaron were for them to go out to get to 8,600. Kind of tough to reach that. Now, if we then say, well, maybe there are 2 additional generations, maybe the other families married and had kids faster than Moses and Aaron's particular line. We add 2 additional generations, we have to have an average 29 males per generation. If there are 3, then you need an average of 9 males per person. And you start saying, okay, that's more doable. But understand that's 9 males, that's not counting the females. So if you're thinking about how many males to females, if it's 50-50, you need an average, every family needs at least 18 kids on average in each generation to get to 8,600 people. Okay, so is there a possibility of a skipped generation? The answer is yes. There's a strong hint that there's a few more generations in there than are listed. Because if the 4 generations all there is, it's really tough to get. I don't know about you, but it'd be really tough to have 860 kids in 1 generation, or even 2. You know, it's just getting that number. That's just the males. I haven't counted the females yet. It gets to be really tough to get those numbers in. So again, there seems to be an indication that there's skipped generations. They're not all listed. We only have the highlights. So in other words, for those who want to use Moses' lineage as an upper bound on the length of the Egyptian bondage, an assumption has to be made that there are no additional generations. And then you run into a problem when you do that. So what ends up happening, and here's... Oh, that's an eye chart. I'm sorry. I tried to get... It took me an hour and a half to get that eye chart up there. But if you try to get, you know, from the time of Abraham, if we say that's year 1, and list out everything that's there, Genesis, all of Exodus 12, verses 40 to 41 fit with Galatians 3, 17, that measure basically the same time period. The 400 years of slavery start 30 years after they went in. That fits with Genesis 15, 13, 14, Acts 7, verse 6. Acts 13 measures from the beginning of the bondage to the conquest of Canaan. The life of Moses fits in there. The wilderness wandering, the Canaan. All we're missing is we don't know exactly how many generations here. We can't exactly explain it all. There are a few puzzles. But none of them require a conclusion that there's a contradiction within the Bible. All it requires a conclusion of is, we don't know. We're missing some information. See, some search out any thread to disbelieve just because believing leads to a wanting to change. If you believe what the Bible says, then it says you need to change. If I can find some reason not to believe the Bible, then people say, I don't have to change. Rather than resisting improving ourselves, what we ought to do is understand that we need to submit to God. and that God's word is consistent. There isn't really any proven contradictions in the scriptures. Each one can be shown there is a way to explain it. There's a lot of lists out there. But this is just one. I know it took a long time just to explain this one. But I want to cover all the possible variations of all the arguments that were being presented. And again, it's not meant to encourage someone to become a child of God, but rather than to understand and have a little bit more confidence in what the Bible says. And a little more confidence in talking to other people who disbelieve what the Bible says. I hope you'll think about those things. We'd like to offer an opportunity tonight. If there's anyone here who's not yet a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. For those of you who are children of God, we'd like the prayers of brethren on your behalf. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song Selected.